Well, this is our third lesson on the prophet Isaiah. And at this point, I get a little paranoid because I think that we've had, as I've always said, the Old Testament is more difficult to study. It really helps you to get some background. And now I can't just keep reiterating the background. And yet, you know, people come in and out of studies, and they may or may not have that. But there are just a few things I want to, you know, make sure everybody's got. First of all, 8th century B.C., 800 years before the time of Christ, this prophet has his career, and he leaves us, or his followers leave us, a book that'll amount to 66 chapters when it's put in book form and parsed into chapters. Of course, they didn't have books and chapters back then. They had scrolls, and so things were a little differently. Worked a little. So we're 8th century before Jesus Christ, 66 chapters. We're in the city of Jerusalem. There are a couple big players that are up that everybody needs to know. Assyria will be the first one. Say something about Assyria. Anything? What'd she say? Bad. Yeah. There. Assyria is a drag. It's a threatening, menacing, huge country. Now, its fortunes wax and wane. It isn't always quite as threatening as it is at other times, but for the most part, the whole life of Isaiah will be in the shadow of a place called Assyria. Assyria is not on the map anymore. It would be Iraq, Turkey, would involve some of Syria. In those days, there's also another player that's in Syria. A little different, you know, spelling. Syria still exists at this time. Actually, if you have certain Bibles, it'll be called Aram, or Aram, people will say. It's another big player. It's the big city in Syria. Damascus, right. Still there. And why do you know Damascus from the rest of the Bible? What'd you say, Cora? Oh, I thought somebody said something. Somebody mumbled something. Was it you, Naomi? Yeah, Saul was on his way to get the Christians in Damascus when Jesus appeared to him. And, of course, he gets to Damascus and the whole dramatic story from the book of Acts. And he spends some time there, and they have to lower him over in the basket out the wall, things like that. But that's 800 years later. Another player is Israel, and another Judah. And remember, the kingdom has divided. These are the Jews. Judah is the principal player we have to see. But the kingdom's divided. Now, the odd thing here is that even though Israel and Judah are the Jews, Israel and Syria are the partners. And so, in some ways, for this book, what you'll see is that Judah lives under the twin threats of Assyria and Syria and Israel. And Syria and Israel are trying to break the lock that Assyria has on the whole world, and they want Judah to enter the conspiracy with them. And Judah doesn't particularly feel like a strong player that's a safe bet. Now, there are all the other old countries are kicking around at this time. I mean, Egypt's in on this act and all kinds of other things. But you kind of need to know this stuff just to make sense of what's happening, because the first 39 chapters of those 66 tie a lot. There are a lot of references to these kinds of things in the book. And if you don't know them, you'll find some nice inspirational language, and you'll find some quotations in particular that the New Testament uses, but you won't have a clue how Isaiah was read by the original readers. And remember, I said this is one of the principal ideas with which I approached the Bible, is to understand it as the original reader might have understood it. Three kings have been under consideration, and I keep reiterating their names just so they're not so foreign to you. Uzziah, Ahaz, Hezekiah, and one of the things I said too is pretty good, really bad, very good. And most of the book of Isaiah really interfaces with this king, Hezekiah. And we didn't study him. When we were picking out different things about the kings and their backgrounds, we kind of left Hezekiah out of it, and that's because we're going to have to keep coming back to him. But the best part of it, is through his reign. Now, if you remember something about either of these kings, give me a marker that will help you identify these guys as players. Give me a marker for Uzziah. Yeah, very good. And what happened with his leprosy? Yeah, very good. You know, and a lot of priests, what, 60 priests, and you know, they came in to stop him from doing this. You know, it's not his role as the king to play the role of the priest. And the Old Testament is very clear about that at a couple points, and most particularly in his case. So he gets struck with leprosy as a kind of a miraculous event as it's happening, as he leaves the temple. And so lepers in those days, of course, are sequestered, kept away from the population. So his son becomes a co-regent with him for about 12 years. But their reign lasts about 52 years. Yeah, the leper marker, that's a good one to get going for him. And the other thing to remember about his reign is it's very prosperous, and that for the most part, he's a very good king, and he's kind of an inventive and progressive leader. All right, give me a marker to make Ahaz memorable. I said he's very bad. And we rest our case. At that point, all his other abominable acts, you know, that haunt this man's kingdom. The fact that he turned his own child into a human sacrifice, you'd say, well, that's an epitaph. Now, oddly enough, we'll see, we're going to encounter him in this book a couple of times. I mean, Isaiah has dealings with him. And we've kind of left Hezekiah out of it. Okay, one more thing to look at here. Where did we end our story last week? Where did we end our study? Do you remember? We did the same thing last week we'd done the first week. Revelation, what did we read? Yeah, very good. Remember what quotation and where it was in the book of Revelation? You're on to it. You're making your way towards the truth here. I just kept thinking that, you know, when Catholics would talk about the real presence of Christ in the host, and they would say, well, Jesus said, this is my body, this is my blood, we're going to take it literally. And I think it was Zwingli who said, well, he also said he was the vine, but that doesn't mean he's a plant. And he also said he was the door, but that doesn't mean he was made out of wood. When he said that, all I could think of were those quotations there. But he was the key. So we're in Revelation 3:7. We were talking to the church in Philadelphia, if you come from Pittsburgh and don't like that other city on the other side of the state. Philadelphia. These things say, he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. Well, that's an interesting quotation. Now, if you go back and look at that in Isaiah, I think it's Isaiah 27, you'll find, or 22, verse 7, you'll find that. You'll find that the reference doesn't appear to be to the Messiah. Remember, if you're quoting Isaiah, you're going 800 years before the time of Jesus. But yet this quotation is there to say, who is speaking to the church? Well, the one who holds the key of David. If he shuts it, it's shut. If he opens it, it's opened. You know, the definition's there for him. Where did we end the week before that? Do you remember? Luke at the synagogue in? Yeah, Jesus in his hometown of Nazareth. Luke chapter 4. He finds the scroll. He opens the scroll to Isaiah. By the way, you know, opening a scroll to Isaiah would be no easy matter if it weren't marked, right? I mean, like, I think a scroll of Luke was 30 feet long, right? I mean, Isaiah might have been. That's a long scroll. I imagine, I don't know if it's broken up, but if you've ever gone to a synagogue, they have markers that keep those scrolls kind of turned to the right place, because the rabbi has to come out there. If you were like, you couldn't like everybody bring their Bible and look up Isaiah. You know, they all pull out their scrolls and start trying to get to the right place in Isaiah. You can imagine the chaos that would be. It's interesting stuff, right? I mean, it used to be on scrolls, all that stuff. It was very... That was one of the first things I learned in classical Greeks was a quotation from the librarian at Alexandria, a great library, one of the libraries of antiquity. The guy's name was Telemachus, and he had to park the scrolls, you know, at the library, because there weren't books back then. And a lot of early Greek students, one of the first things you learn is the quote by Telemachus, which is, a big book is a big pain. And, so what do you do with an oversized scroll? You know, I mean, it's just like really annoying. Believe me, you're learning the Bible when you hear this stuff. Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Nazareth, his hometown, he looks up the passage from Isaiah, and what does that passage say? Do you remember, Vicki? Yeah, he's appointed me to preach. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, has anointed me to preach the good news, to proclaim, you know, liberty for the captive, sight for the blind, you know, all that stuff. I mean, it's real dramatic stuff. And then, of course, Jesus sits down and says, today what? Yeah, today, you know, this prophecy is fulfilled right in your hearing. I mean, what a moment. What a moment. If you didn't believe in Jesus, you'd think, what a kook. You know, I mean, how dare you say such a thing? But you know, people are beginning to believe to him. He will prove it's true. The kingdom was going to be launched. Well, a couple of things here that I want to point out here. One, if you look up those passages in Isaiah, you will find that their application in the New Testament is very surprising. In other words, often when the New Testament writers, I believe, writing with the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, choose passages from the Old Testament, if you were just reading them, applying the method I've said, reading it and understanding it as the original reader, you'd be really startled at how it gets applied in the New Testament. Don't be surprised by that. I mean, it's something all Bible readers have to cope with, that the use of the Old Testament in the New Testament is a little startling sometimes. Or it would appear to be out of context with the history of it. That's no problem for me, because I feel like the Lord knew what he was doing with this. But the question is, we say Isaiah is a prophet, and we have to say, what is prophecy? Well, I said, prophecy, yes, it's about prediction. That's an element in prophecy, to predict what's going to happen. But that's one element in prophecy. Another element of prophecy might be to give clarity, to give insight, to give focus to something that's vague. The prophet told you what was happening. All these events were happening and you didn't understand why. They told you why. In other words, you know, the natural world appears to be spinning and moving according to natural law, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we're all happy with natural law, gravity and, you know, events and sequences like that. But behind that natural process are other things going on. The prophet's the one who has the insight to that, tells you why it's happening. So in some cases, you know, why are things not going well? Or why shouldn't we trust in our riches? Or why would it be a bad idea to form a partnership with Egypt right now? Well, the prophet's the one who goes to that. So when the New Testament gets to Jesus, and they want to tell, in particular, it's the original readers there, who is Jesus? It's phenomenal the number of times they go to the book of Isaiah to give clarity and insight as who are we dealing with? And that this is not just made up. This is, you know, long foretold and foreshadowed. Prophecy's tricky. But, you know, if you want to understand who Jesus is, well, the New Testament writer so often went and said, well, this is who he is. He's the one who holds the key of David. If he's the one, if he opens, you can't close it. And if he closes, you can't open it. Who is he? Oh, he's the one who picks up the scroll and says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, has appointed me to preach the good news and release to the captives. And so that's why the value of studying Isaiah is, you know, for us as Christians, is, you know, to stand where those original Christians were and say, well, this is who Jesus is. Is that fun? I think it is. I mean, I think it's really, I mean, fun might not be the best way to describe it, but to me, it's thrilling to think that. So let's dig a little deeper into Isaiah now. You have to find the book, first of all. It's on page 597 in my Bible. Comes after that other one, Song of Solomon, which is also hard for a lot of people to find. One way to do it might be to sort of open the Bible to the middle, and you will probably end up close to the book of Psalms, and then just keep going right, and then you will find the book of Isaiah quickly. All right. prophets wrote, but they didn't sit down to compose books. They delivered their prophecies in many formats. Sometimes they wrote, sometimes they spoke, sometimes they acted things out. How you actually assemble the book of Isaiah is kind of hard to say. I mean, the Bible doesn't really tell us how that came about. It is assumed, and it's not a bad assumption, that there are actually indicators that he has a group of followers, kind of disciples, who are around him. They're actually kind of referred to behind the text a couple times. So they're kind of the people who assist him. We assume kind of assemble what he did in his life, and then they put together what we have as the book of Isaiah. And they pop up every once in a while in the Bible. You just see hints that they're kind of, I don't want to say editors, because editors sound like they're middlemen who are interfering with God. That's not what they were doing. I mean, I think they were operating, you know, in the same way with some inspiration. But they assemble the book of Isaiah, and how do you describe it? Well, it's not like a modern book. Somebody didn't sit down and write it beginning to end. So how do you think about this book of Isaiah? What is it as a book? A collection, an assembled collection. Now, and I assume we don't want to think of that as a random thing. You know, I mean, if somebody's going to sit down and say, you know, look, I sat at Isaiah's feet for 30 years, and I think I know, you know, what's going on here, and I, you know, even since the leading of the Holy Spirit, you wouldn't just do it at random, sloppily. You know, nobody would let you get away with that, right? Because Isaiah's a big popular figure. I mean, if you were to start corrupting things, I mean, you'd hear about it, probably. What do you call this in literature? Anybody know? An assembled collection of writings? Very good. An anthology. Yeah. So most people think that the book of Isaiah is an anthology of his prophecies assembled, and therefore, that, you know, an anthology, you know, is kind of hard to say. Now, the first thing we get going is that we'll look at the first five chapters. You say, well, what are the first five chapters of Isaiah? Because there's 66 there. In chapter 6, you get a real abrupt kind of thing where Isaiah himself seems to be indicating that his ministry stepped up. You know, he sees God and his commission to be a prophet. Now, the question is, are these in chronological order? Well, yeah, I mean, in one sense. In chapter 6, we'll see that there are some chronological markers. But 1 through 5 is an interesting set of chapters here, and it's hard to say. It matches, in some ways, the very early days of Isaiah's situation, but in some ways it may prove to be an overture. What an overture is? Yeah, you know, like in an opera, right, or something like that. If you have the overture, it kind of goes through the themes of each thing there. There are people who have looked at these chapters differently. We'll have to see. Well, let's look at chapters 1 through 5. And let me get someone. We've already read verse 1. So you can't say you've never read Isaiah yet here. I mean, I don't know if you remember. We read chapter 1, verse 1. The vision of Isaiah, son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Now, would somebody read us verses 2 and 3? not exactly luring him in, lighting him up with a few good jokes and lighthearted anecdotes, right? It's a... I have nourished and brought up children. They have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, the donkey its masters, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider. So what would you say the situation is for Isaiah? Well, you'd think. I mean, you know, because, you know, in a sense you think, well, right away you start to see that there's a downer about all this, you know, and if politics needs some yes men, you know, I mean, and especially in those days, because politics weren't, the power kind of concentrates, right, in the king. I mean, he's not going to play the part of a yes man very well. I mean, it seems like God's got issues with the people who have rebelled against him. And if Isaiah is going to be the messenger of that, he does have tough sledding. I mean, he's got a rough role to play. And we'll see, that's one of the reasons I say this is an overture, because we'll see in a sense this is the commission that Isaiah gets. Isaiah seems to be, there have been lots of speculations as to who exactly he was, and people argue about it, but he's very closely connected to the court. And see, he has the ear of three kings. I mean, how do you get that? Well, I mean, you probably have to be born into a powerful family and have that so that you can be a courtier. You know, you can be somebody who's there and has the ear of everybody. And it does seem like he gets the ear of each king, even the bad ones. You know, I kind of, you know, defer to Isaiah. Okay, well, that's enough to get a picture of this. I mean, I hope you'll start studying it on your own. Yeah, that's a picture of what happens in Isaiah. Here's God's charge at the very beginning of the chapter. And so you can imagine that the rest of the book, in some ways, defines, delineates, you know, takes off from that point.
All right.
Yeah. It's threatening, is it? Well, it seems a little threatening, right? Yeah, it seems like things are bad. Well, that's very much what's going on here. Well, let's look at Isaiah chapter 5. Now, you'll see that a lot of this, you know, is very similar, and we have to jump around. I think of this as an anthology. And, well, let's just look at 5, and somebody read us verse 1 and 2. You see the connection here, right, with what we've already read in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1. Right? He says, now I'm going to do what? Sing a song. And, you know, and apparently in Hebrew it's quite beautiful. I mean, if I've read enough of my Hebrew isn't good enough to picture beauty versus not beauty when I'm reading Hebrew, but, you know, the experts who do say it's a beautiful song. It rhymes and it's wonderful. It's a work there. So we see that once again, it's got different things he communicated to it. Now, I don't think he necessarily wrote this down. Perhaps it was even sung. Who knows? But of my beloved, what does that say to you? Now let me sing a song to my well-beloved, a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. Beloved gets strangely romantic to me. I'm not sure it works for me there. It probably is a word that indicates a close and dear friend. And who is being referred to here? God. God. He's going to a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. And what does he say about it? I gave this vineyard everything it needed to flourish and to be beautiful. And you think these images here are just tremendous. I mean, we don't have vineyards around here, do we? But think of what would be an analogy for us that would maybe speak to us in this way?
Orchard.
I'm thinking, yeah, cornfield, I don't know. You have to be a real hardcore farmer to like go, no, that is a dandy corn. Who are farmers here? Charlie, do you get that? Do you like your heart thrill at the sight of a beautiful cornfield? I used to when I got to Alabama, there were all kinds of Alabamans here this morning, by the way. I remember watching them do cotton in the South. I could just stand there and watch harvesters go through cotton fields, and cotton fields just seemed so exotic to me. I thought, whoa. You see that field? Cotton fields are pretty, I think, you know, and then they'd harvest them, and it's just fascinating. I never got tired of it. But then I remember I had something of a similar reaction when I moved north again after 13 years, because for some reason I never was around, like, corn harvesting in the South, and saw the big corn fields here. So actually, I can appreciate that. They are beautiful in their way. Cabbage, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just trying to picture, how do you think of, this is a song, this is beautiful, and this is what God has done. And I mean, he's doing this intentionally to make the pitch. I think, you know, a bunch of teetotaling Mennonites, I mean, vineyards are kind of like, you know, it's kind of, you know, I don't know if God should plant a vineyard. I mean, after all, but I'm just thinking the Jew looked at that and said, that's the source of so much of our joy and our prosperity and what's going on here. Now, I don't want to you know, get into a fight about alcohol. I don't drink. But I mean, I just want to say, I want to get a picture of something that's beautiful before us, something that's cultivated, something he did everything for, and it was just wonderful. And it was intended to be a delight and a joy and a wonderful place that made everybody happy when they saw it. But it didn't happen, did it? He expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. Somebody read us verse 7. Okay. In chorus. He's saying, well, all right. That, who was it? Well, Israel and Judah. I mean, he says they both. And what in particular seems to offend the eye of God, spoil the vineyard? Bloodshed. Is that what it says in your translation? What did you read, Rob?
Yeah, bloodshed.
Okay. Okay, yeah. I have a lack of justice and behold oppression. I don't have bloodshed. And so I was thrown because I was going to ask what we were referring to here. But we can go with it. Lack of justice. Bloodshed. And I'll put my oppression beside that. Anything else? A cry for help, which means what? Why do people cry for help? Yeah, I mean, somebody is in a situation. Well, you cry for help when you are powerless or feel powerless to remedy the situation yourself, right? I mean, you don't cry for help unless you are in some disadvantaged situation. You know, you're being washed downstream at a rapid rate or something like that. I mean, you know. People cry for help under specific circumstances. Well, I'm thinking, well, this is really interesting, because when we think of sin, what do we think of? Well, I mean, 9 times out of 10, we think of personal sin, don't we? I mean, the things we do that are, you know, kind of personal issues that hang us up, you know, vices and things like that. And it's very interesting. Now, mind you, those things matter. Those things can be sinful, and Isaiah puts a few of them in this prophecy at different points of the book. But at this point, that's not exactly what he's saying is ruining the vineyard. He's saying a lack of justice, bloodshed, and oppression are happening. Well, what kind of things would that indicate? I mean, what are we looking at? Yeah, national problems happen because of national people. But what's that? Well, you know, I suppose bloodshed could be a part of that in some cases, and a lack of justice. But what kind of things happen when there's a lack of justice? Yeah, grinding. Well, you know, there's slavery and then there's slavery, right? I mean, you know, there's slavery where, you know, it's legally instituted, but there's also an oppressive life, you know, where people are held down. People can't find their potential, can't live good lives because they're being oppressed by somebody. And, well, you know, what are the elements of a lack of justice? Well, that always helps. But what happens when there's a lack of justice? I guess that's what I'm driving at. What would it, if we say there's a lack of justice, what do you mean by that? Corruption, and what does that do? Yeah, well, I mean, it was clearly there. Well, I'm just curious. I mean, justice is not served, you know, for whatever reason. I'm just thinking, well, you know, you take a case to court and the judge takes a bribe, you know. This person isn't treated equitably. Is that the word, equitably? Equitably. Sorry, I'm missing a syllable there. I thought that sounded wrong. Equally. Equality and justice for all. I don't know why. There's like some little cell in my brain where the electric charge isn't getting to that word. I don't know what it is. Yeah, it's not equality before the law, you'd think. You know, and probably, you know, oppression. People, you know, you can't win. You know, you things are taken away from you that belong to you. you can't achieve because. I mean, I just think, what are the elements of a lack of justice that frustrate people so terribly? You know, and I think that is not God's intention for life in his kingdom, that there would be inequality and that there would be a lack of justice. That if he's present, then these things walk with him. And I just think, well, as I say, sometimes our view of sin and righteousness is pretty small. You know, I don't think it's wrong, but I think it's partial. And I think when you start reading the prophets, you start thinking, they have an eye on this stuff. They don't like it when widows and orphans aren't taken care of, when the strangers in the land say, you yourselves were strangers. Don't oppress the stranger. You know, the fatherless, you know, don't oppress the fatherless. You know, and these kinds of things start to really come off the lips of the prophet. I'm saying it's not all social denunciation, but that's a bigger element of it than we usually give credit. Okay, so that I think will also give us a picture of what the kind of thing Isaiah's working on. Anybody else want to comment on that, by the way? My stomach's growling. Okay, well let's move ahead then and look at chapter 6. Like I said, 1-5 somehow have the background, it seems, maybe of the affluence of the time of Uzziah, and things like that, things that are happening. But as I said, I think there's also a sense in which they're an overture to the rest of the book. Chapter 6 really marks a moment in the book because Isaiah gets his calling. I'm sure you've heard this many times. There are some real famous moments in this. For example, in verse 3, Isaiah will hear the kind of angelic beings crying, holy, 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 trishagion, you know, the thing that's in hymnals and, you know, so often used. Would somebody read us in chapter 6, just verse 1? Very good. Isaiah has this moment in the year Isaiah died, and I believe it's a vision, you know, or, you know, I'll let other people argue, you know, when people have this, where are they and what's happening? I assume a vision, but there are others who tease that out a little bit differently. And he sees God, and spend some time describing this. And actually, it's not entirely a pleasant experience for him. In verse 4, he'll say, woe is me, I am undone, because a man of unclean lips, a people of unclean lips, my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. They say that the common notion was, you know, that a human being can't see God without dying. That comes to you, but you have to qualify that a little bit with the story of Moses and some things that happen there. You know the story of how they take the coal and put it on his lips and all that kind of thing. Would I get somebody to read now verses 8 through 10? He gets this commission. The altar, they take put the coal on his lips so he can speak, and then verses 8 through 10 kind of give us more of his commission. So he's already got a prophetic career. He has a stunning moment, though, where he has this vision. He senses, you know, God's presence and you know, I'm sure this is a startling moment for him. And it makes him eager to serve, prepared to serve. His commission is given. How would you describe the commission he's given? Yeah, Rob gets a call to a church. You know, go to that church, offend them all and they're all going to hate you, you know. It's going to be a lot of fun. Everybody will be miserable at the end of that process. You know, you think, yeah, I don't want that job. You know, I want it to be. The thing is with Jesse, is that exactly what's happening there? I mean, is it exactly as you described? Is he to go and do that? Or is what he's to do ultimately going to achieve that? Even though he doesn't have, you know, he will continue to do what a prophet ought to do, try to make it clear. But as he makes it clear, it just, the result will be dullness. As he declares it right, their ears are heavy, their eyes start to shut. I don't know, you know, Vicki? Yeah, telling him that success in his case really will be that he goes and testifies, but this is the result. So it's not like, you know, go preach a boring sermon, you know, because that'll make everybody's ears ears heavy and shut their eyes in no time. You know, that's actually a pretty easy job. We should get that job. Because, you know, what would be easier than that? You know, I mean, you wouldn't have to work at trying to coax anybody's attention toward you. You just let a soporific spirit, isn't that a wonderful term, you know, haunt the room. So I don't know. Do anybody want to elaborate? I mean, this is a very interesting thing. I mean, a prophet's being sent out and saying, but what's going to happen? Well, as he speaks. Yeah, to do what Isaiah had to do without this remarkable vision and things would be, you know, just horrible. I mean, you just think you were failing when in fact you were succeeding in doing this. Well, you know, I think we'd have to say, I mean, my opinion is that to some extent this is cryptic. I understand, there is this expression, they say it's kind of in Hebrew, of kind of expressing this way, not that he's causing it, but that the results are already in the act of the things that are being done. But it does have a purpose. And we say, and he says, well, how long do I have to do that? Until the cities are laid waste and without inhabitant, the houses are without a man, the land is utterly desolate, the Lord has removed men far away, and forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. But yet a tenth will be in it, and will return and be for consuming, as a terebinth tree or as an oak, whose stump remains when it is cut down, so the holy seed shall be its stump. And it seems like he's trying to do what? Do what? Yeah, but what's it look like? If you had to describe that process, what would you be doing? Yeah, I think it's shock pruning. I think it's not what they call it when you're trying to, you know, cut your rose bush down to a quarter of an inch and then shock it into growth. I don't know. It does seem like there is a sense in which, well, yeah, it's going to be bad, you know. But I am going to. Oh, what's a word that describes this? Purge. You know, it's a radical measure in which I'm going to, you know, all but begin again. You know, but that's your job to bring it to this place. Well, it's a fascinating thing. Let's do one more set of verses then. As we'll say, all right, let's put this in motion now. I mean, at this point, we know, well, this is going to be interesting as I read the rest of the book, because I'm going to see that there's going to be tremendous resistance to what this man says. And it won't necessarily have a happy ending within his lifetime. We're going to end up at a stump. So look at 7, and could somebody read us 7:1? Okay, well, let's look at that. Ahaz, you know, right? Marker for Ahaz? Bad. Sacrificed his own child. Okay, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah. That Rezin, king of Syria. Now remember Syria as a player. And Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up against to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. Syria and Israel being to team up against Judah. The problem is this: it's sometimes called the Syro-Ephraimite coalition. I think Ephraim for the northern tribe of Israel. They want Judah to join a conspiracy with them against Assyria. And they think, well, that'll give us three things. But as I said, Judah is a reluctant player. They don't want to be called into that game. Assyria is a vicious and overpowering place. Remember how I said that they often picked on the weakest village, you know, to make an example of it? Well, if Assyria were going to try to break a coalition of three, Judah would have been the weak partner, would have been the likely candidate, perhaps, for Sennacherib and the Assyrians. Attack that. We'll make Judah look so bad that, you know, the other big, the psychological warfare effects will be enormous, and, you know, the coalition between Israel and Syria will fail. I mean, you have to think this way a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure I'm not the strategist at the time, but Judah thinks this is a bad bargain. And Isaiah, of course, and the Lord will be telling him, it's a bad bargain. Don't go there. I have other plans here. I can protect you. I can make things stand up for you. But the thing is, at this point, we're going to start to see all kinds of prophecies unfold. And this is a dramatic time. These assaults against Jerusalem and Judah, these are not little Mickey Mouse things where everybody goes about their business. They'll involve sieges and all kinds of very threatening moments to people's well-being and life, and we'll see it. But I think we better stop for today, and we'll jump in there next week with some of the things that the prophet Isaiah will say about this coalition that's come against Judah. And God isn't impressed with the coalition. Any comments? Any final words here? Yeah, Abraham. Yeah. Yeah, well, you probably noticed in your Isaiah a lot of things try to give it a kind of a versification. That's not the way it looks in the Hebrew, but I mean there are equivalents there. Hebrew poetry was very differently. So was God a poet? I said, well, absolutely, positively. Are there prose sections that connect the poetry sections? Yes, I think that would be necessary to assemble a good anthology. To me, I think it's probably an indication that these things are oral at first, because poetry and things expressed in poetry sometimes are much more memorable and more easily delivered and land on the ear a little better. That would be my take on it. Do you have something you wanted to say about it? You know, English poetry is in meter and rhyme. Hebrew poetry wasn't. It was in the it's different. So it doesn't hit us as poetry, but it hit the Hebrew as poetry. And it's a little bit of a complex study. As I said, even having studied some Hebrew, I don't get it. It's not poetry in my soul. But the use of images that are subject to interpretation, that call you in to understand them a little better. If you don't read poetry, I mean, if you're the kind of person who just reads manuals, I mean, I think you probably have trouble with Isaiah, you know, or any of the prophets, because there are things there that call you in, you know. But we're kind of on an anti-poetry roll here, aren't we? You know, the last 100 years or so, like poetry. That's what sissies read, you know. I mean, but poetry is, it gets you places mentally where prose can't. It opens up parts of the mind with visions, you know, that the things that you can't express clearly otherwise are expressed in poetry. So, long live the poets. They're not all sissies. Anyway, anyone else? Thank you. Well, we'll keep going now. We're into Isaiah.